Few figures in American history have held as many roles in public life as John Quincy Adams, who served as the sixth president of the United States between 1824 and 1829. He was a fierce nationalist who spent much of his early career in the courts of European powers, hobnobbing with czars and kings and princesses. He was a brilliant ambassador and secretary of state whose diplomatic victories shaped the continental United States and laid the groundwork for its expansion. He was also a frustrated president at a historic turning point in American politics. The name of James Traub's new book is John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit. James Traub is a columnist and a regular contributor at foreignpolicy.com and teaches foreign policy at New York University. Again, the name of the new book is John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit, and it's a pleasure to welcome James Traub to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure.
Delighted to be here.
What brought you to want to explore the life of John Quincy Adams?
Well, you know, it happened in sequence. I was about to be teaching a class in U.S. foreign policy, so I was doing some background research in 19th century foreign policy. So, of course, I read about Adams, who was a great Secretary of State then. And he seemed like such an interesting figure. I thought, well, I should read the good biography on him so I could learn more. And then I discovered there really hadn't been a good book written about him in 60 years. There had been a great two-volume biography written in 1950 and 56, but nothing really good since then, which I was surprised to see because founding fathers or quasi-founding fathers like him are usually such sort of oversubscribed figures. Then I discovered something which I hadn't realized, which is that he kept a diary every day of his life from the time he was 18 almost to the time he died. And that is a kind of record of a man's voice that not only doesn't exist for other presidents, it exists for very few public figures of any kind. And the more I learned about his life, the more fascinating I found him. And so I thought, this guy is perfect.
And perfect in what way? Perfect for being a good subject. And nuanced, I assume.
Yeah, okay. So when I say perfect, I mean, I have to admit that I tend to shy away from morally super clear things. You know, I've never written about the civil rights movement, for example. I mean, I've never written about things that are obviously good and bad. Adams has a tremendous moral force in him, which I felt enormously. But at the same time, he was in many ways an almost reactionary figure as a conservative who had been deeply shaped by his father and by the other founding fathers. And so that when the moment came along when America was becoming a truly democratic country, represented by Andrew Jackson, Adams represented the opposite. He represented the old-fashioned New England quasi-aristocratic view. Adams was not a nice person. He was a terribly harsh person. He was bearish. The very qualities that I most admired in him, his moral uprightness, his tremendous intelligence, his deep commitment to his own convictions, also in many ways made him a bad president. So I think there was something in the kind of chiaroscuro of this man, the fact that he doesn't play himself out in such straightforward terms, that was particularly appealing to me.
Yes, you talk about this political courage that he had, which is admirable, except it often doesn't make the greatest president because he's speaking the truth, he's defying his party, he's defying his friends, and as you write, it costs him dearly.
It's unusual to write a book about a president where you say his presidency is the least impressive part of his tenure, but it's true in Adams's case. And so he came into office in 1824 when he won with a very ambitious agenda. He had a big government, we would call it today, agenda. He wanted to build a chain of national universities and academies. He wanted to build roads. He wanted to build observatories, astronomical observatories, which he called lighthouses of the sky. And so you would think, if you had an agenda like that, you would think to yourself, okay, how can I prepare the Congress and the public for such a decisive break with the past? Adams never did that. He didn't believe in doing that. He wasn't entirely convinced that he needed to do that. So even though, in fact, he was facing a hostile Congress, and it became more so after the midterm elections in 1826. He gave a speech where he said, "This is what we must do." And then he allowed these things to happen on their own, which, of course, they didn't. And so his Secretary of State, Henry Clay, who was a kind of LBJ figure, very, very crafty, said to Adams, "Look, don't propose these things. Don't propose what you cannot accomplish. It will discredit you." And Adams said, "But they are the right things to do, and if they won't happen now, then they will happen later." Well, Adams was wrong about that, and Clay was right.
You refer to him as a frustrated president. What frustrated him about the presidency?
He had spent many years in jobs which were not elective positions. He had been a U.S. senator. He was later to be a congressman. But he had been a diplomat for years. He had been a secretary of the State Department for 8 years. And I think he was accustomed to acting on his own. Or rather, let's say, in the cabinet of James Monroe, they would have a big argument. And Adams would say what he thought, and the others would say what they thought, and then they would argue until somebody won, and Adams often won. And so that was his idea about how you accomplish things. You laid out a case for the merits, you stuck to them persistently, and you basically wore everybody down. Well, you can't do that as an elective politician. It doesn't work. He found his inability to get his own way frustrating. He found political opposition frustrating. He always attributed political opposition to personal opposition. They are out to get me. As opposed to, you know, what is the fact of politics, which is they want what you have. They want the political power you have. That's just normal. And so the strange thing about the man is that he spent his whole career in politics. He loved politics as controversy, as fighting for justice. But politics as we understand it, the need to engage in all the forms of compromise you engage in order to accomplish what you want to accomplish, he wasn't good at, he didn't believe it, and he couldn't do it.
But as an ambassador and as Secretary of State, he was brilliant.
Yeah. So much of that, especially as, you know, in those days, ambassadors, when they were, of course, many, many months away by letter back and forth, you know, this is, we're talking about the 1790s. He becomes ambassador to the Netherlands in 1795, and then Prussia, which, you know, now Berlin after that. And so really what an ambassador was a kind of, he was an eye on the European political scene. And so his perceptions of what was happening in Europe, that was what mattered most. And Adams was an incredibly perceptive person. And so Adams could see that, you know, early on in the years after the French Revolution, that France was posing a profound danger to all of Europe. And he believed France was posing a danger to the United States. That may have been exaggerated, but the United States came very close to having a war with France in 1798, what we now call the quasi-war, because it was a naval war but never became a full-blown war. And so first George Washington, and then Adams' father, John Adams, who of course succeeded Washington as president, became deeply dependent on Adams's perceptions of the world, which he would send in long, long letters. And in fact, John Adams had a secret back channel with his son. So Adams would send letters to the Secretary of State, and then he would send different letters, much more candid and much longer, to his father, John Adams.
Talk a little bit about how he set out this strategic and very coherent vision of American expansion, both at home well as abroad.
Yeah. Right. That's what's so striking. And the foreign policy thing comes first, and the domestic comes later because he was a diplomat before he was a domestic politician. So for Adams, the crucial thing always was, how can we protect the republic from dangers abroad, and how can we expand the republic at home? And so protecting from dangers abroad for him meant very much what it meant for George Washington, which is, we must maintain our neutrality at least until we're strong enough to be able to stand up to any of our rivals. And so in the face of many temptations to fall into conflict, Adams was extremely skeptical in the case of this conflict with France in 1798 and elsewhere. At the same time, he believed very strongly in military preparedness when he saw that conflict coming. And so when the British were menacing American shipping starting in around 1806, 1807 or so, when Adams was in the Senate, He was one of the few guys in New England, because New England was really afraid of any kind of American measure that would wind up harming American shipping. If, for example, you put an embargo on the British, that would obviously hurt New England's merchant economy. Adams said, no, we have to be prepared. We've got to stand up to the British, because the only language they understand is the language of force. And so he was prepared actually to jeopardize his own political standing in New England by standing with Thomas Jefferson in order to have an embargo against the British. So that kind of carefully modulated foreign policy. Domestic policy, the view was America is destined to expand across the continent. So if you put the two together, you would say in order to guarantee America's expansion across the continent, America has to solve all of its problems abroad so that they don't encroach. It's a little bit like the way China would used to use the word peaceful rise. Let's assure a peaceful international setting so that we can work out our own contradictions and conflicts in order to maximally grow and prosper at home.
After the presidency, he didn't leave government. He went into the House of Representatives. And when we think of lifelong politicians, that's what this guy was.
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing. You know, his father had been the previous guy who had lost after one term. And his father went home to the farm like you were supposed to do, you know, and sent long letters to Thomas Jefferson and grumbled and bumbled and this and that, but lived for 26 years at home. Adams thought he would do the same thing, retire to the basically his orchard and his flowers in Quincy, Massachusetts. But when friends of his approached him 2 years or so after he came home and said, look, there's an open seat, we need you to fill it, that is the 8th Congressional District of Massachusetts where he lived, he said, as long as I don't have to really run, as long as it can be handed to me on a platter, I'll take it. And my subtitle, Militant Spirit, comes from a letter he wrote to his son. The son was saying, please, will you please stop doing politics? It only gets all of us in trouble. And Adams said, no, I have a militant spirit, and I cannot live without controversy. So he returns to the Congress in 1832, spends the last 16 years of his life there, and it is there that the great last chapter of his life is written, because he becomes the great opponent of slavery while he's in the Congress.
And up until, the age of 80, is very much doing the job on the floor of the House.
Yeah, I mean, he dies at age 80. He has a massive stroke while he is sitting at his desk in session in Congress about 1 p.m. in the afternoon. They're having a debate over giving pensions to veterans of the Spanish Civil War. Adams was almost alone in having opposed the war and therefore opposed the pensions. And he appeared to kind of rise up to say something, and then he was stricken and lay in state in the Speaker of the House's office for 2 days before dying.
When you look at the book as a whole and his life as a whole, what do you hope that the reader gets out of it about this man's legacy?
I guess the moral underpinning of it to me is this was a man who always stood alone, who was always prepared to leave his party and to anger his own constituents based on principle. And for that reason, in many ways, he failed. He was a failed president because of that extreme principled quality. And yet, it was that same principled quality that allowed him to stand up to the slave power in Congress year after year after year, often alone, until finally he was vindicated in 1845 when he succeeded in putting an end to what was called the gag rule, which had prevented petitions asking for the end of slavery to come before the House. And so there's a wonderful and quite unexpected vindication in Adams' life. He didn't think he'd be vindicated in life. He hoped he'd be vindicated by posterity. And yet, by the time his congressional tenure had come to an end, he was viewed as a hero for the exact same principled stand that had made him seem like a kind of an exotic figure and even a reactionary during the time that he was president.
The name of the book, John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit. It is published by Basic Books. James Traub, thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit, published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.